to help put out a newspaper. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Anthony Shadid has died of an apparent asthma attack in Syria. His employer, the New York Times, says he was there without knowledge of the Syrian government. Last year, he told WHYY's Fresh Air why he was willing to risk getting into Syria, whose government has been keeping nearly all reporters out as it tries to crush opposition.
I was frustrated in not being able to meet these people that I had been reporting about for so long. I think Syria is often covered by phone. You have to talk to activists. You have to try to, you know, read the tea leaves. You have to try to get to government officials.
A colleague says Shadid's asthma attack came on as he apparently reacted to being near horses involved in his transport. The colleague, a photographer traveling with him, carried Shadid's body across the border into Turkey. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at subaruofchampaign.com or 352-4700. Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. 10,000 Villages is celebrating 26 years of trading fairly in Champaign-Urbana, offering eco-friendly handcrafted decor and gift items from around the world. A gift from 10,000 Villages is a gift that gives twice.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we are happy to have back here again on the program David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois. And once a month, almost on a Friday, he is here to talk about investing in money management. And we've been doing this program for a long time to give folks who are listening a regular, predictable opportunity to ask very specific questions about their own situation. So what we do here is Dave begins by making a few comments, and then if people have questions about that or if you want to talk about your own investing situation and if you have questions, you'd like to get some advice, Dave would do his best to help you out. And with all that, we say, hey, thanks for being here once again. Glad to have you here again.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's really a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, let's begin with some positive news, a red-hot, on-fire stock market. In fact, every asset class is showing substantial gains during the first 45 days of 2012. The bellwether S&P 500 index, that's sort of our benchmark, is ahead some 8.3% for the year. The emerging markets index has surged almost double, 16%. Since the beginning of the year. In fact, the trailing index in 2012 is the REIT index, the Real Estate Investment Trust Index, and it too is ahead some 7.5% for year to date. In particular, our couch potato portfolio, which consists of 8 U.S. and international Vanguard index funds, has surged some 11% since December 31, 2011. In other words, thus far in 2012, diversification is actually paying off as our couch potato portfolio is outperforming our benchmark S&P 500 index by almost 3%. And I believe the portfolio was updated this morning, and you can find that website, of course, at WILLAM 580. Click on Focus and click on Couch Potato Portfolio to look at the individual indexes that I utilize. We've been using the same for a number of years, as well as the current percentage asset allocation, which incidentally did not change since last year. I was contemplating a change in the emerging markets, but I did not make that change. Now, of course, there are any number of reasons for the surging stock market. U.S. consumer confidence continues to trend upward each month. And strong retail sales were reported in January, significantly higher than a year ago, significantly higher than most economists thought would ring in the new year. Job creation, although not robust, seems to be growing at about 200,000 jobs per month. And, of course, we have record low interest rates and a federal government slash reserve intent on maintaining those low interest rates. After all, when you think about a $14, $15 trillion federal deficit. You add interest rates to that mix and you move them up by 1%. That about $150 billion added just to the federal deficit. So obviously there is a tacit and long-term attempt to keep these interest rates quite low. And most interesting, I think, is continued solid performance of the U.S. manufacturing sector, which has really spurred job creation and reduced so-called unemployment to a level of 8.3%, the lowest level we've seen in more than 30 months. Of course, real unemployment is estimated at closer to some 16 to 17%. If one considers the American workers who have literally dropped out of the job scene, not seeking work, or those who are simply underemployed. It's still a massive number indeed. Now, while our GDP continues to grow, there are, of course, any number of international and geopolitical events that could stall out our economic growth. For example, surging oil prices, well over $100 a barrel today. Well, we could probably point to a whole lot of reasons. The Iranian situation, the Israeli situation, the issues over the Strait of Hormuz, a Greek economy literally in terrible shape, a very angry Greek citizenry. And while apparently the political people over there have said, yes, we're going to go along, we're going to kowtow to the EU, we're going to make these changes, as we heard just 5 minutes ago on the news, on our very station here, is it really going to happen? And what would a default really mean under that tremendous number of billions of dollars of government debt and the attendant write-offs? And, of course, a start-and-stop U.S. housing market, where actual housing prices in some areas of the country seem to be stabilizing. But interestingly enough, when we look at the Case-Shiller Index, which tracks approximately 20 of the major metropolitan areas of the country, almost all of them were still trending lower in January of 2012. But, of course, it's an election year, and I think the incumbents obviously will try very hard to take steps that, at least in the short run, will boost the GDP and continue to lower unemployment. Now, in spite of a surging stock market and some repair to previously hemorrhaged retirement plans, more than 50% of Americans over the age of 65 still say their number one concern is not Medicare. Their number one concern continues to be running out of money, essentially running out of money before they run out of life. Now, interestingly enough, something that has not been widely reported, Congress may be listening and some federal agencies may be listening, as legislation is now being considered that would require an employer to offer an annuity option in a 401k plan or a profit-sharing plan. If you're in a pension plan, typically you will be under an annuity option, but not so in a 401k plan or a profit-sharing plan. So this is something to follow to see whether or not when you retire and you have a corpus, you have an amount of money in a 401k plan, call it $2.50 or $2.5 million, typically now the onus and the burden of investment responsibility falls on you, the participant. How you're going to handle that money in the future, you do not have an annuitized option. And this is something that Congress and various branches are now considering. Should we require employers to offer an annuitized option with that principal buildup in your 401k? Now, recall that an annuity is nothing more than a stream of regular periodic payments. And one of the more popular annuities today, especially, are something called immediate annuities. And an example and a very good analysis of annuities, and specifically immediate annuities, appeared in the Fidelity website back on February 10th. And basically, what an immediate annuity is, you hand over a lump sum of money to an insurance company. That's who's going to take your money. And then each month, that insurance company pays you a monthly amount of money. For example, take a 65-year-old male, And that 65-year-old says, okay, insurance company, I'm going to hand you $100,000. And I want to receive an immediate annuity. Today, that annuitant would receive somewhere about $585 a month for the rest of his life. And a female, because females live longer than the guys, she would receive something less, probably in the neighborhood of about $550 a month. Now, there's all kinds of annuities that I've talked about, but of course, remember that if you elect an immediate annuity, you've parted with your money. You've handed that money to an insurance company, and they have a naked promise to pay you for the rest of your life. There are immediate annuities based upon two lives, which would be a joint and survivor immediate annuity. Now, there's a great website. It's called immediateannuities.com. And you can actually go based upon your age to that website, based upon some principal amount, or based upon some monthly amount you would like an insurance company to pay you. You can play on that website, and you can work either way and say, how much money would I have to put in to earn this amount of money each month from the insurance company? Or I have this sum of money. What would the insurance company pay me? Now, of course, there are many, many different kinds of annuities. There are single premium deferred annuities. That's called an SPDA. That's great for accumulation. You basically take a sum of money, hand it to an insurance company, and watch it grow on a tax-deferred basis. Typically, after age 59 and a half, you then start accessing that money. But, of course, the money that you take out is subject to taxation. Something not really very popular and often misunderstood is something called a longevity annuity. That's an annuity where you hand a sum of money today to an insurance company. Maybe I'm 65 years old, and I say, hey, insurance company, don't send me any money today, but start making payments to me at age 75. What would my payment look like at age 75? There are inflation-adjusted annuities. That is that you take a smaller sum today, but they are adjusted annually for inflation. They're becoming more popular. You have to do a lot of research and be very, very careful about inflation-adjusted annuities. And then for charitably-minded folks, and I think this makes a great deal of sense in contradistinction to an immediate annuity, is a gift annuity. And that is that you make a gift to a charity of your choice, and then each month or each quarter or each year, they pay you back a sum of money. It sort of works like an immediate annuity. The big difference is that you are benefiting a charity sometime in the future when you die or when, based upon a joint life, two of you have passed away. The charity receives the remainder of that money that is left. And indeed, you're getting a tax deduction up front because you have parted with that money. And presumably, not all of that money is going to be spent on you during the rest of your life. So there are IRS annuity tables that will tell you what the nature of that tax deduction is. So if we have further questions about annuities or any other kinds of financial planning techniques on your mind, please, please, please feel free to ask questions during this hour. So there you have it, David, a very, very hot stock market, lots of international events, and I guess we'll all stay tuned.
All right. David Sinnoh is our guest. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Once a month on a Friday, he is here, and we talk about investing and money management. We have a caller ready to go. Others are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us your question by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And here is our first caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm sorry, this isn't about annuities. It's about capital gains.
Okay.
That's fine.
Okay. In January of 2008, I bought shares in a foreign fund from T. Rowe Price. And shortly afterwards, it totally tanked. Okay, I have never recovered my initial purchase price over these, what, 3-4 years. Then, at the end of January, I get a statement from T. Rowe Price that I have, like, this huge amount of long-term capital gains. Where did that money come from?
Isn't that interesting? And this happens in a mutual fund. Now, is this mutual fund held inside a tax retirement vehicle or outside?
No. Outside.
Okay. And I take it that you have not sold any of your shares?
Nothing.
None of your shares. Well, what has happened is that you bought that particular fund basically at its highs. That's what really happened. Let's say that you paid $10 a share, and lo and behold, as a result of the financial crisis, that stock or those shares dropped to $7 a share. All right? And that's probably what happened, that you really are underwater in terms of the total amount of principal that you invested because the actual share value dropped. Remember that a mutual fund contains any number of stocks, and those stocks go up and down each day, and those stocks can move very, very precipitously and very dramatically in some type of foreign or emerging market fund. But each of those shares of stock that is held by that mutual fund pays dividends, may or may not pay dividends, and also those underlying shares can be sold. So if those shares are sold and the fund itself holds those at a lower historical cost, that gain is going to be shared by all of you, even though your total mutual fund share price has dropped in value. So it's very, very complicated. And this is especially an egregious result for foreign funds because they are so volatile. And you can essentially have a capital gains situation arise even though the total value of your overall fund is less than what you invested. Now, here's the good news. The good news is that every time that you have a capital gain and it's really paid out as a dividend, that adds to your basis. That adds to your basis. So someday when you sell, and hopefully you sell at a gain, you may then not have to pay any capital gains tax on your actual sale of the shares of the T. Rowe Price Fund. Now, did that analysis make any sense to you at all?
Sort of. It's just not fair. And who
it's not fair. It's not fair. So here's a tip. It's very, very difficult to invest. When did you invest in this particular fund?
January of 2008.
Ah, okay. So there were some imputed capital gains that were already sitting in that fund as of January 2008 that had not been distributed. So this is a tough lesson to learn, and that is that before you invest in a mutual fund, if you're going to be in an after-tax investment, not inside an IRA, not inside a 401k, you have to check and call the fund itself or the fund representative and say, hey, are there any undistributed capital gains in this fund that are going to be distributed over the next calendar year? Because if there are substantial funds, you may then decide to buy a different fund that doesn't put you in that situation. So I'm sorry I don't have a better answer for you.
No, but
you're caught between a rock and a hard place.
Right, but at least I understand what the size of the rock.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right,
very
my pleasure.
Good.
We'll continue here at Talk Next with someone in Sullivan, line two. Hello.
Hi, I'm calling with a question about being in the SIR system, especially for those of us who only have maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years in. And it looks like there's going to be some pretty dramatic changes in the ways that we pay into the pension and what kind of pension we get out of it. So I wondered what kind of advice you might have to offer those of us in that position. And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen to your response on the air.
Okay, now that's a very tough question because we're talking theoretically here. All right, and before you hung up, I really wanted to know what area of the SIRS system you were in. And I'm going to presume that you had elected into the traditional system where you would earn a pension sometime in the future when you retire, as opposed to being self-managed, where you simply put money aside And then the university or wherever you are in the SERS system is matching that, and you are vesting with those particular funds. Now, we hear every day something about the pension system. And we are now hearing out of Springfield something very interesting, and that is that everybody who works for the state of Illinois is really not a state of Illinois employee. The teachers shouldn't be considered state of Illinois employees. That university people should not be considered state of Illinois employees. And in fact, the governor is telling us that only about 22% of all people in pension systems are really working directly for the state of Illinois. And so the conclusion that the governor is pushing and articulating is, well, if that's really the case, then the institution itself, like the local school district, like the University of Illinois, all institutions flush with money should pay more for the various people under their pension system. And obviously, I'm saying that facetiously. The truth of the matter is that, as we know, that the state of Illinois, which is all of us, we're all to blame because we have let our legislators and the political system get away with the fact that they have not properly funded the pension system. Employees have funded the pension system, but the state of Illinois has not. And there's 1,000 reasons that we don't need to go there. And David, you've probably had 50 programs and 50 inquiries about this already. And that really doesn't address the question that the listener asked. The listener asked a question and said, hey, I'm into the system for 5 or 6 years. Changes are coming. We don't know what those changes are. And of course, they're going to be argued about. There are going to be constitutional challenges to these changes. So it's anybody's guess when changes are going to actually be initiated. A couple of changes that seem to me that are more likely than not. One change is, and I think this one will pass constitutional muster, at least in my personal view, is that pensions have never been subject to state income tax. All right? So if you are an Illinois pensioner and you live in the state of Illinois, then you don't pay state income tax on that pension. I don't think there's a very good constitutional argument to say that you can escape paying state income tax under the Illinois state constitution. I think that one is coming. That's the first one. We've already made changes to the system for new hires. And that is that their pension, if they opt into a defined benefit system, will be based on maximum $106,800, which is the current Social Security maximum subject to Social Security. So that's changed. So someone who is earning more than that is going to still be required to use as a maximum salary cap $106,800. That change has already been made, but that doesn't deal with apparently somewhere between $80 and $85 billion of underfunded pension systems in the state of Illinois. So it doesn't make it very difficult to understand that somewhere that money is going to have to be made up. The state of Illinois is going to have to put more money into the system because constitutionally they're required to do that. And probably after a lot of court battles, because of the economic exigencies that exist in the state of Illinois, individuals are going to be faced with different choices. And the popular choices that are being thrown out there are, number one, hey, employee, put more money out of your paycheck into the system if you want to stay in the traditional pension system. And the numbers that are being bandied about are approximately double as to what you are putting in currently, which would be a massive hardship for a number of folks, especially for the majority of folks who don't make that much money as employees currently. And of course, people who have taken positions with the state, with the university, typically are not part of the Social Security system. And we've got to keep that in mind. So when these people retire, they are not going to be able to look to Social Security for additional pension benefits. So one thing that is likely to happen, or one proposal or one piece of legislation is we're going to put more burden on individual employees if you want to stay in the current system. A second idea that has been bandied about is to freeze your benefit based upon the number of years you've got in your system. So if you have 5, 6 years, whatever you have accrued, we're going to freeze that. And if you don't want to put more money in, then you move over to a 401k type system where your contribution will go in for your benefit into a 401k. And then your employer and or the state will make some type of matching benefit. I think that's going to run into a lot of legal issues, and I think there's going to be a big battle over that. But I think ultimately there are going to be significant changes, and I think ultimately when they reach the state Supreme Court, those changes are going to be upheld under the financial exigencies that are being faced by the state of Illinois. Now, that is my personal opinion of what is likely to happen. And so we're going to stay tuned to the legislature after elections, probably in what, that late period in November, December of 2012, when everyone is sort of sleeping, that these things typically happen very, very quickly. Suddenly there is what, David, a midnight vote? And these things come down.
Well, I guess we'll have to see. I don't know that anybody is expecting anything particularly dramatic to happen before the election. And whether it happens after the election or maybe it happens early in 2013, I think that everyone expects that. And, you know, this is something that we're going to be talking with a number of candidates with. And it's one of the top questions on my list of people of things to ask people about. We know we have a problem. Something has to be done. The problem is that nobody really seems to agree on what. So I think the thing, you know, we'll try to provide opportunities for some more conversation about it, and people are just going to have to follow this very carefully and see what happens. And it's going to make, I think that it's going to be make a big difference between whether you've been in the system a long time, a little time, or you're just coming into the system.
Another complementary issue which people are not focusing on, which I think is certainly as important, if not more dramatic, than the shortfall in the pension system, is that the state of Illinois subsidizes every state employee for medical insurance. And this is a huge number. And there is nothing, as far as I know, in the Constitution which is going to inhibit the state of Illinois from requiring all of its employees to shoulder more of the monthly responsibility, okay, for payment of that insurance premium. And that could be very dramatic because many, many folks today are paying anywhere from, what, $75 to $200 a month? Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, retired folks are having it completely subsidized under their pension systems. That certainly is going to change. And those basic monthly premiums could jump dramatically, and that could have a major impact on everyone's economic life. So I'm equally, if not more, concerned about how we're going to deal with that issue as well as the shortfall in the pension system. So changes are definitely coming. And, David, I applaud you and WILL for getting candidates and holding their feet to the fire and say, what are you planning to do? What is your position on this matter? Yeah.
Well, we'll talk some more with David Sinnoh. We have a couple of callers here we'll take in just a moment. First, though, we have to take a short break, and then we'll be back. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Truppen, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week. You can check the schedule by going to our website. It's wyll.illinois.edu. I want to mention that we will have another candidate. We'll have several of them before the primary here on the show. We'll have another next week, and that is Shane Cultra. He's an Illinois state senator, is running for his party spot on the ballot. He's a Republican, running for his party spot on the ballot in the new 53rd Senate district. So he'll be with us on Tuesday. Next week, the governor, Governor Pat Quinn, will be giving his budget address. So we'll have some more details on what he is thinking about in terms of the state financing. And then after that, the next day, Thursday, we will talk about the budget with two guests, both of them following Illinois politics for a very long time. Both have been on this program before a number of times. Fred Gertz, who's an economist, and also Bob Rich, who is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at University of Illinois. So we'll talk about what the governor has to say. And I'm sure that one of the things we'll talk about is a kind of proposal, at least an idea that the folks there at the Institute have put on the table for changes in the way the pension system is structured. So I'm sure we'll get into that as well next week. You can follow us on Twitter, Will Public Media. You can also find us on Facebook. And, of course, our website is wyll.illinois.edu. In this hour of focus, David Sinnoh is the guest. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month, on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management, and we have several callers. In fact, the lines are full. So we'll get back at it go to Bloomington for the next caller, someone who's been patient with us. So we'll get right there. Line four. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I'm retirement age, and I have not retired yet, but I have a choice between taking a lump sum of my pension or the pension. Now, my company's pension fund is very underfunded, so I thought about taking this lump sum, but I don't know how did I determine what company to buy an annuity from. I don't want to get involved, you know, in a Bernie Madoff type thing. So how do you know which companies are going to be there for the next 30, 40 years to give your money to manage its annuity?
Let me ask you a couple of questions. Does your current pension, they give you the option of saying, yes, you can have a lump sum, or here's the annuitized payment we will pay you? Is that the arrangement you currently have? So you could simply opt into the annuity that this particular company and pension system offers.
Yes.
Okay. Is this a private pension system or a public pension system?
No, it's private.
Okay. And the other alternative is to take a lump sum and either roll it into a self-directed investment or take that lump sum and purchase an annuity with it.
Right.
So you have those choices. And the question that you're asking is, how do I go about locating, talking to a company so that if I were to take this lump sum, hand it to them, that I would feel fairly comfortable that they would make good on their promise?
Exactly.
All right. So have you done any research? Have you reached out to any companies thus far?
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of financial people. I don't know. It seems like they're just trying to sell products.
Yeah, they're trying to sell products. Has your company plan, is your company large enough where you have a consultant or a fiduciary with the plan who provides educational advice?
I have not located that person yet. I would think there would be such a person.
Okay. I think the first thing that you want to do is you want to go back to your plan and your plan administrator and see what type of educational advice, because clearly this question certainly has come up in the past.
Okay.
And whether there is a person who will advise you or someone that they refer you to. Now, in terms of reaching out to insurance companies, it's not that difficult. You can go to AM Best ratings of insurance companies, and you want to look for a AAA or AA+ insurance company. And they are often very, very large mutual insurance companies or stock companies. I won't mention individual names, but you would be familiar with all of them. You want a company that has been in business for many, many, many years. After all, you want the insurance company to outlive your life, right?
Right.
And you can then locate people at these insurance companies, really even through a general agency, who can provide you information as to the kind of annuity that they offer. And does your particular company offer only a life annuity or a joint and survivor annuity?
Yeah, they had a survivor option.
Okay, right. So you could compare apples and apples. So what I would do first is go back to your company, see what kind of educational information or if there is a point person assigned to this question. Number two, go on the AM Best website, AM Best, and look at AA and AAA companies, names that you are familiar with. Reach out to them and say, I'm looking at the possibility of having this lump sum. I'm considering a joint and survivor annuity. Here's my age. Here's my spouse's age. Here's our situation. Give me a number. Give me a quote. So I think it's not all that difficult if you want to spend a little bit of time before you retire so you can figure out your options.
Okay. Is it true that most of these companies, you get a better rate of return the bigger your lump sum is?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
That is not true. Now, another thing that you can do is go to the website immediateannuities.com and you can plug in your age. You can plug in the amount that you're going to be receiving at retirement. And you'll get a very, very good idea, whether it's a life annuity or joint and survivor, of the kind of monthly annuity that you could expect.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All absolutely.
Right. Very good. We'll continue. Our guest, by the way, is David Sino. He is here with us once a month. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. We've been doing this program for a long time to give you a regular opportunity to ask investing questions, and that's what we're all about. We have several people here ready to go and about 15 minutes perhaps left in this part of Focus. So we will come back here locally and next talk with someone in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get back to the previous question about SIRS and the changes in the SIRS system, because David Sino mentioned the lame duck session as a possible time when there would be changes made. And I wanted to remind listeners and see if you have any comments about the fact that given that in the last lame duck session was when the governor got the tax increase through the legislature. And the way he did it was with lame duck Democrats who had been defeated and then went back on their campaign promises, even though they campaigned against the tax increase. They then voted for it, and some of them have gotten, accused of being paid off with future appointments, such as the most recent one with the new agricultural director, Flyder.
That's certainly one characterization, isn't
right.
it?
I don't know if it's true or not. I leave that for others to investigate. There have been, at least six people who've been investigated about this. But what I want to do is raise that. So even if candidates promise that they're against whatever changes in the SIRS system, maybe we also need to ask them, will they keep their promise even if they're defeated? And our Democratic representatives who were defeated didn't keep their promises. So I'll get off the phone and let you talk about this on the air if you have any ideas or comments or suggestions. Thank you.
Well, I think it's very clear what happened in the lame duck session. And I think that characterization is certainly one characterization that makes a good deal of sense. I'm not placing any value judgment on it. The point is that historically, these very, very tough decisions have often been made at midnight in these kinds of lame duck sessions. And what we can do about it is to cast light on it, to have discussions about it, to have WILL programs that David obviously is going to have about it. And those are the kinds of things that we can do because I, for one, and I know David believes this, that transparency is best. And most of the time, transparency is best. Otherwise, it comes back to haunt you. And the more that we can make the process transparent, I think the better.
Yeah. We will continue here. I want to thank the caller and go to line two. And this is someone in Sullivan. Hello.
Hi, I'm following up on my earlier question about in CSRS. And
sure.
You're right. I am in the traditional CSRS program. And I'm calling because I also have a 403B that I contribute to through TIA Crafts. And I put aside 20% of my take-home into savings.
Good for you.
I'm wondering how I should do that more smartly now that I'm at a point where I have, you know, people recommend a 3-month safety cushion and I have $1,000, like, immediate emergency cushion. Well, now what should I be doing?
Well, I'm very proud of you, number one, because I don't know very many people that take 20% of their paycheck, putting it in TIA CREF, and in addition, since you are in the CSRS system, you have in excess of 8% going into the CSRS system. So,
well, I only put in 2.5% to TIA CREF. The 20% is from my take-home, and I just put that in a savings account.
Oh, okay. Well, I think that one of the things that you might consider doing is increasing your TIA CREF contribution on a monthly basis if you have built up this savings account and you feel comfortable with your nest egg. Because each dollar that you place in TIA CREF, number one, is your dollar. It's not someone else's. It belongs to you. That dollar may go up and down in value, but nevertheless, it's yours. No one can take it away from you. And number two, each of those dollars that you place in TIA CREF or a 403B plan is not currently subject to federal or state income tax. So right out of the box, if you're in a 15% federal tax bracket, a 20, whatever it is between federal and state, you are being subsidized at that tax rate. So presumably that enables you to save more and defer more inside your 403B plan. Now, I want to ask you another question. Are you still on the air?
Yes.
Okay. Give me a range of your age. Are you in the 30 to 40 category, for example, age-wise? Or are you 40 to 50 category? Where are you at kind of age-wise?
I'm 45.
Okay.
I just got into the CSRS system in 2005.
Okay.
And I'm rather grouchy about having to forfeit all those years that I put into Social Security.
Well, how many years did you have in Social Security?
Well, I worked from the age of 13 to, you know, 37.
Okay. Well, you're not, this is often misunderstood, you're not going to sacrifice all of those years in Social Security. Social Security is broken down. The payment that you receive is based upon three different tiers of earnings. And depending upon what your earnings were, you may, because of the number of years that you put in Social Security, may sacrifice up to about 50% of that first tier. And that first tier currently is in the $650 to $700 range. I've forgotten exactly. So you may be giving up $300 to $400 of your Social Security. But you're not giving up Social Security in its entirety. And indeed, you may have additional years down the road in Social Security. There is this thing called a Social Security offset, which you're talking about, if you are in another pension system. But you will still be receiving some Social Security if you had substantial earnings in Social Security, and you could go back and see the number of years that you had substantial earnings in the Social Security system. Nevertheless, at age 45, do you intend to work for the next 15 to 20 years?
Oh, I'd rather it were less than 20 years.
15?
I'd like to try for that.
Okay. Well, that's a long time. And I would suggest that at age 45, that probably the majority of the funds that you have invested in TIA, CREF, it's a great place to invest funds, the majority of it, maybe 55, 60% of it, should be dollar cost averaged in the future into the equities as opposed to TIAA into the CREF portion. And there are many good choices. There is CREF Stock. There's CREF International. There are a lot of good choices with CREF. It's almost like indexing your money. So in answer to your question, put some more money into TIA CREF, a little less into the nest egg if you feel comfortable, and slant that future money, 55, maybe 60% into the CREF portion and 35 to 40% into the TIAA portion.
All right. Thanks very much. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll get one more here, and this is someone who is in Urbana. This is line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I must say I agree with most of what you've been saying today, but I'd like to make one comment on something I think no one, and particularly the state government, is considering with this benefits package for the university and for teachers. If they go ahead and they impose a draconian solution, the University of Illinois is already not among the leaders in the Big Ten in paying faculty staff. If they make it even less attractive to be employed here, they're going to experience some drain on experienced faculty and a much heavier problem with attracting new faculty staff. And I can see the university dropping out of the position of leadership it at present enjoys. And this is not going to do anything for the state economy. And I don't hear many people commenting on this.
I think there are a lot of folks that are quite worried about the issue that you've raised. And I've discussed it myself in many circles with prominent people at the University of Illinois. I happen to agree with you. I may be dead wrong. We may both be dead wrong. But I happen to agree with your long-term view. The University of Illinois is the engine, is one of the primary engines for the state of Illinois. We know that for every dollar that comes in to a university system, it is repaid many-fold in benefits for our citizens of the state of Illinois. And I, too, am concerned that when benefits drop precipitously, and I agree with you that experienced faculty, it will be tougher. I think it will be tougher to recruit them. The University of Illinois, though, is truly a gem. We are a leader, both in research and in so many areas. And I agree with you. It would just be a tragedy if we lost some of that reputation. There's no question about it. So you're preaching to the choir in some senses.
I thought I might be. We did see something of this in the early 20s, but nothing like what could be coming.
And that's why we, fortunately, at the University of Illinois, we have a very, very strong annuitants association. And I would urge anyone, for example, who is retired to join that association. And for people who are not retired to follow, they are lobbying on behalf of benefits for the university and for other organizations as well. So but there is no question that there's going to be pain, and it's got to be shared pain. And it's important that all of us speak up and articulate our positions on this matter. Mm-hmm. So your points are extremely well taken.
And again, I want to thank the caller. I have a couple of minutes left here. I have another caller. We'd get here, line one. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I'm 24 years old and essentially financially ignorant. I was wondering what I can do to set myself up for the future.
Rule number one, spend less than you earn. All right?
All right.
Read the book, The Millionaire Next Door. Famous book, very simple thesis. Spend less than you earn. Rule number one. Rule number two, in order to spend less than you earn, take some money, have it automatically taken out of your paycheck before you even see it, and place it in some type of savings, retirement, / investment. It might be as simple as something called a Roth IRA, where you are working and you can put a certain amount of money aside for your own retirement. So those are two golden rules. Spend less than you earn. The state of Illinois can't handle that. The federal government can't handle that. And very frankly, most Americans can't handle that. Hopefully you are the exception. And two, have the money taken out of your paycheck so you never see it. So you're paying yourself first. It won't matter whether you go out and buy a CD down at the local bank or you put it in the U.S. stock market. The important thing is to start doing something and doing it early. Those are the two most important rules. There's lots of books you can read. Go to the bookstore. There's 1,000 books that you can read. But I would start with The Millionaire Next Door.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. We're coming to a point here. We have a couple of minutes left. I don't know if there's anything in particular that you would like to say just to, as we have a little bit of time left.
Well, you can see how fickle the stock markets really are. And it's impossible to make a short-term commitment to stock markets because over the last few years, you would be in a world of hurt, so to speak. But if you were careful, you continue to dollar cost average, and then you see the way things spur out of the gate, if you had just simply moved all of your money back into a cash position, you probably would have missed this most recent move. It's impossible to time the market. You look at the 500 wealthiest Americans in the Fortune 500, none of them are market timers. None of them. If it was easy, we'd all be doing it. So we have to do it the old-fashioned way, is make a long-term commitment to world stock markets, and we have to think very, very carefully about our asset allocation. What is a sensible asset allocation, given all of our resources, given our age, et cetera? You've heard me harp about it for the last 20-plus years. Mm-hmm. But some of your money really should be invested very long-term in high-quality, low-expense index funds.
Yeah, and just in terms of interest rates, I think that I have read some things where the Fed is saying that they really think that they will do everything they can to keep rates very low through 2014.
No question about it, David.
Another two and a half years.
Very tough situation for retirees who are wanting CD income. Interest income, very, very tough situation. We're still trying to heal the banks, heal the financial system on the backs of you and I and other people who have assets but are having them sit fallow at basically 0 to 0.1%.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there with the promise that next month Dave will be back. In the meantime, you can check out the Couch Potato Portfolio on our website, will.illinois.edu. See what his asset allocation is, and you see how it's been performing. And then again, he'll be back with us again next month. Dave is a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. Thank you very much.
David, thank you.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, celebrating part 5 of the complete Beethoven Quartet cycle on February 21st with Pacifica Quartet. More information is available at krannertcenter.com or 217-333-6280.
Coming up in the next part of Focus, we will complete a little series that we've been doing this week, trying to get people to think about water in this sense, about the water that comes into your house, you know, what comes out of the tap when you turn it, where that water comes from, the structure that's in place to get it there, and then what happens when it leaves. We'll be finishing up this series in the next hour talking about the history of sewage treatment. Daniel Schneider will be our guest. He's a professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Illinois. He has written a book on this subject. The title of his book is Hybrid Nature, Sewage Treatment and the Contradictions of the Industrial Ecosystem. And he says, in fact, a sewage treatment plant is a kind of industrial ecosystem. We'll get more on that in the next part of the show. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. Stuart Peterson develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information at stuart-peterson.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodities at the halfway point of this Friday and ahead of a three-day weekend. The markets closed on Monday for President's Day. Soybean futures at the Chicago Board of Trade up double digits on news of fresh U.S. soybean sales this morning to China. A weaker U.S. dollar as well as strength in crude oil futures. Brent crude up over $100. In fact, last I looked was over $103. This morning, USDA confirmed sale of 2.92 million tons of U.S. soybeans to China, 2.75 of that for delivery in the 12 and 13 marketing year, the balance this marketing year. Taiwan also today issuing an international tender to purchase 40,000 to 60,000 tons of soybeans, either sourced from the United States or from Brazil.